Welcome to the 173rd episode of the Reading and Writing Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Rutherford. Stay tuned for my interview with Lois Duncan, author of many classic suspense novels for young adults, including I Know What You Did Last Summer and Killing Mr. Griffin. Stay tuned for the interview. The Reading and Writing Podcast is sponsored by the book-loving nerds at Riffle. Riffle is an online book community that connects readers with authors and books that they'll love. Readers use Riffle to find the next book that they want to read. And authors use Riffle to make their books stand out and drive sales. Join the Riffle community today at rifflebooks.com. That's RiffleBooks.com. And look for the link in the show notes as well. Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Lois Duncan. Lois is the author of many classic young adult suspense and horror novels, including Daughters of Eve, Killing Mr. Griffin, Stranger with My Face, and I Know What You Did Last Summer. In 1992, Lois received the Margaret A. Edwards Award, presented by the School Library Journal and the Young Adult Library Services Association, to honor a living author for a distinguished body of adolescent literature. Lois, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Sure. Well, I'm sure you're aware that if you spend any time searching online, you can easily find interviews with both passionate readers and current writers who are gushing about reading many of your young adult novels when they were younger and talking about how influential those books were to them as teen or preteen readers. And I know that when you were writing many of those books, there certainly wasn't a clearly defined young adult market the way that there is now in publishing. What guided you when you were writing those books? Was it just kind of a gut that you were writing what you wanted to read if there was a book, you know, that you could walk into a library or bookstore and buy?
Well, I started submitting stories to magazines when I was 10 years old, and I started selling them when I was 13, and I wrote my first novel when I was 20. And you can imagine, back then, as you say, there was no young adult literature, but I was writing for my peers. So it was very natural for me to be writing in that genre. And then somehow I got moved from that first book, Debutante Hill, which, by the way, first was published in 1957 and has just been reissued as a young adult classic. So I've gone full circle with my very first book, turning out to be one of my very last books as well. And then I somehow fell into the niche of writing suspense novels, probably because I like reading them. Mm-hmm. And they weren't being written very often back then. And so I've launched a genre that wasn't yet known, not realizing what I was doing, just writing what I wanted to write. And those books have remained in print for so many years. Well, most of them still are in print, or they've all been reissued, even going back to books in the 50s.
Sure, sure. And obviously, I mean, I think we should point out, I mean, now if you go into a bookstore, I mean, the shelves are just, you know, overloaded with young adult novels, and most of those are much, much darker than what you've written. But obviously the times were a lot different. Did you ever get any pushback from editors or publishers when you were writing those books?
Almost all of my suspense novels got banned one place or another. That was because of parents worried about what their children were reading. But it's hard to find a book that hasn't been banned for one reason or another. Even The Wizard of Oz has been banned because there was a witch in it. So you can't please everybody, and I just didn't worry about it one way or the other. You're right. Today, there's a lot of much stronger stuff. I never wrote horror. Mm-hmm. I know eye gouging, blood spurting, sensationalized violence. It was always psychological And so that was my forte.
Sure.
And then I also, because I'm so old now, I've had so many years, I've got over 50 books published, and I was able to dabble around in other genres as well.
Exactly. I should mention as well that you also have written children's books as well, including Hotel for Dogs.
Yes, I've written books for little children. I wrote the Hotel for Dogs books that were made into, one of them was made into a movie. And I've written for adults. There were many years when I was a contributing editor for Woman's Day magazine. So I've had a long career and pretty much covered the waterfront.
Sure, sure. Well, you just mentioned earlier that you started writing when you were 10 years old. Do you remember what kind of motivated you, or what kind of appealed to you to sit down when you were 10 to start writing your own stories?
10 was when I started submitting them to magazines.
Okay.
I was writing them before I could hold a pencil. I was making them up and dictating them to my parents. I never thought of being anything but a writer. I was just born to be one. I was never very good at anything else. I never had any desire for anything else. So it wasn't as if one thing launched me. It was just part of me, like breathing.
Sure. And I know, I mean, I'm trying to think of how to ask this. I mean, I know that the you know, again, kind of the times were a little bit different, and I know that you had five kids, and we'll obviously talk about your younger daughter in a moment. But did you find it difficult, as a parent of five kids to keep the writing career going? Were you writing in between naps?
Yes, I was writing in between naps. My kids took naps until the first grade so that I could get some writing done. Once they started school, I had a lot more time.
Sure.
And today, most mothers today are in the workforce, and they have to leave the house in the morning and go work someplace and come back. And I had it much easier than that because I could do it at home, and I could always be available to the kids. And I could take little breaks to run the laundry and go to the grocery store. So it was the ideal career for a young mother.
Sure, sure. Well, I know that you mentioned earlier your first novel, Debutante Hill, is being republished as a classic. How did it feel to go back and read that early novel?
To do it, Jeff?
To go back and read that early novel.
Oh, it was a strange feeling because I'd forgotten it. And I had to order it on Amazon and read it. It was as if it were written by somebody else. And when I was first approached about having it republished after being out of print for so long, I was horrified. I thought, well, it must be just awful. I wrote it so long ago, and it must be so amateurish, and who would want to read it now? But I read it anyway, and I was surprised that it had held up extremely well over the years. It's now getting reviewed as though it were a brand new book, and everybody likes it. So the books we were writing back then were written very carefully because we were writing on manual typewriters. You make one word wrong and you don't do a search and change on it, or you retype the whole blasted page. And so everybody who was writing then was writing with extreme care. Today we could just move anything around, cutting it and pasting it and taking it from one chapter and moving it to another. But it was harder then, and because of that, I think the quality of the writing was, in general, better than a lot of the quality of the writing is today. Because today you can just slap it out.
Sure.
And people can self-publish it.
Sure.
And back then, we were competing very hard with other dedicated writers. We were competing for the publishers, and we had to be careful what we submitted.
Sure. Well, I mentioned earlier your youngest daughter. To shift gears a little bit, tragically, in July 1989, your youngest daughter, Caitlin, was murdered in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Your daughter was 18 at the time, and the murder is still unsolved. And you've written about your personal tragedy and your daughter's murder in two nonfiction books, Who Killed My Daughter, and most recently in a new book, One to the Wolves, On the Trail of the Killer. I know it must still be painful for you, but for those listeners who may not know about your younger daughter's case and murder, can you tell us a little bit about that, and also what kind of motivated you to write a second nonfiction book, One to the Wolves?
Kate was chased down in her car and shot twice in the head. And the police in Albuquerque called it a random drive-by shooting. Our family almost immediately began to uncover information that showed it was not, that it was a calculated hit, that Kate had learned about illegal activities and was in a position to blow the whistle on them. And we had strong reason to believe that she was assassinated. The police would not look at that possibility. They closed the unsolved case as a random drive-by shooting, wouldn't consider anything else, and they said they were never going to investigate any further. And so I didn't feel I had any option other than to write a book that contained all the information we'd gotten that the public didn't know about. And that was Who Killed My Daughter. The police were not at all happy that book was published. We began getting death threats to the rest of the family, so we left Albuquerque. And in the intervening years, because of that book, it threw me onto the talk circuit. So I was on all the shows, Larry King and Good Morning America and Unsolved Mysteries and Sally Jesse Raphael. And that book became extremely well known. And the police had never thought this could happen because they thought I was a writer of little children's stories. Nobody would ever have an interest in this teenage girl in Albuquerque who was randomly shot, and it was a shock to them to find out that suddenly Kate was a poster child for families all over the country whose children's homicides had been misclassified. And because of that, all these other people began contacting us through a website with new information about Kate's case, and we began finding out things we'd never even guessed when I wrote the first book. And it accumulated to such a degree that I thought, well, the only way to get it out there is to write a second one. So I wrote One to the Wolves, On the Trail of a Killer. And the title was based upon something my old son Brett said. It was like our family had been this naive flock of sheep that all believed that as long as we grazed gently in our pasture and didn't make any problems for anybody, we would all be safe. And that suddenly the wolves broke into our family flock and took off with one of our lambs. So it was One to the Wolves.
Sure.
And that was, and another interesting thing is that when Kate was 10, she drew this horrifying picture of a wolf coming in the moonlight to kill her. And I found that picture drawn by a 10-year-old. And I thought, how could a sunny-natured little 10-year-old come up with this? And Is it possible that even back then she was having nightmares about a predator who would come for her 8 years later? And we used that picture on the cover of One to the Wolves. And it's probably the first time a murder victim ever created a cover for her own book about her own murder.
Sure, sure. And why do you think the police were reluctant to investigate further? Do you think it was a situation where kind of institutional kind of resistance, if they're under the spotlight as opposed to being kind of open to, you know, hearing feedback from outside and pursuing it? Do you have any sense of why they were resistant?
Our speculation is that some of the things Kate was going to blow the whistle on were being protected by political VIPs who were in a position to control the police investigation. We think it was a deliberate cover up.
And is the murder still? They're not actively investigating it.
No, they're not. It's interesting. It's classified. If you ask them, they'll say the case is open, and because it hasn't been solved. Well, if a case is open, it means that it belongs to the investigating department, and no other outside agency can come in and investigate it. So by saying it's open, they're keeping out anyone else who wants to get involved. Even the FBI wanted to get involved, and they can't because murder is not a federal crime. They have to be invited in by the police, who wouldn't invite them. But they also say it's inactive, which means they don't have to investigate it. And so you're in a bind. No one else can investigate it, and they don't plan to investigate it. And the only weapon I had was my ability to write, and that's what I used.
And do you have a sense that if the politicians or powers in Albuquerque were to change significantly over the years, that maybe you would see new movement investigating your daughter's murder?
No, I just see it feeding on itself with more and more of the same. And we're not the only family by a long shot that has been affected by what is political corruption involving importation of drugs. And that has gone on, and it looks like it's going to continue to go on. As we speak, the Department of Justice is in Albuquerque doing an in-depth investigation of corruption in the Albuquerque Police Department, but nobody's allowed to know what they find or what they do about it. So we just know they're there.
Sure. Do you have a sense, or have you, so to speak, kind of pointed the finger at a specific person or individual that you think did murder your daughter?
No, I have no idea who pulled the trigger. I'm speculating that it was probably a hired hitman.
Okay.
So what we are interested in is who was behind it and who was orchestrating the cover-up of it. And by putting all the facts that we've learned into One to the Wolves, what we were hoping to do is to just spread it all out on the table and let people draw their own conclusions. And I believe they will draw the same conclusions that we've drawn. But I can't risk a libel suit by pointing a finger and saying that particular man was behind
it. Sure. Well, again, that the name of that book is One to the Wolves. It's available as an ebook. I'll have a link to it in the show notes. So if someone listening to this is interested, they can either search and find it or go to
It was published by Planet Ann Rule. And, you know, Ann Rule is the top true crime writer in the country. Mm-hmm. And she took a deep interest in Kate's murder. And she has started her own ebook publishing company, and she wanted to be the one to bring it out. And hopefully, before long, it will also be out in a physical form. But right now, it's only an ebook. It can be downloaded onto Kindles, Nooks, or any other e-readers.
Sure. And so if you're listening and you're interested and want to read more, take a look for that One to the Wolves. Again, I'll have a link in the show notes that you can to the book. If someone listening on the remote chance were to know anything about your daughter's murder or the case, who can they contact at this point?
They can contact us. And my email address is all over the internet. Anybody, sure. Anybody who wants to reach me can do so.
Okay.
And I can put them in touch with our private investigator, if that would make them more comfortable than talking to me directly.
Okay. And I'll have a link to your website as well and that people can go to. So
thank you.
Great. So are you working at this point? Are you working on a new novel?
No, I'm not. I feel like I've come full circle now. I've brought Kate's case full circle. My young adult books have gone full circle, and they're all coming back into print. And I just finished updating 14 of them to bring them into the 21st century and give the kids cell phones and computers and change their hairstyles and make them so that today's young readers relate to them better. So that was kind of a fun chore. And they're all now coming out as movies. Down a Dark Hall has been optioned by Ficklefish Films, which is run by Stephanie Meyer, who wrote the Twilight series. And we are very hopeful that that will come out as a big screen movie before long.
That's great. So given your years of success as a writer, do you have any writing tips or advice for aspiring writers who may be listening, who would want to have their own stories and novels published?
I don't think there's any secret to it. I think it comes with dedicated practice. You just sit down every day and you work. And you submit things, and if they're rejected, you try to figure out what was wrong with them. And if you can, you rewrite them and you send them somewhere else. And you treat it like a business. And yet, to me, it was always more than a business. It was also the joy of my life. And it's wonderful when you can have a career that also is your hobby.
That's wonderful. Well, again, we've been speaking with Lois Duncan, the award-winning writer of many classic young adult novels. Lois, thanks for taking the time to do this interview and talk to us.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
Thank you.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.